Welcome to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Defense stocks just put up their best week of the year, and the question isn't whether the rally was real. It's whether the aviation sector as a whole is repricing around a new operating reality driven by the Strait of Hormuz crisis.
We've got a Honeywell spinoff that started trading, an Allegiant guidance flip that turned a 50-cent loss into a $1.25 profit, and defense primes up 8 to 18% in a single week. There's a lot to unpack here.
And we're going to connect all of it, because this week had a coherent narrative underneath the noise. Let's get into it.
So let me frame where we're starting. The narrative this week was a structural separation between aviation businesses with balance sheet flexibility and those without. And the fuel crisis is acting as the accelerant that's making that gap visible.
That's exactly right. And operationally, what that means is carriers and suppliers with access to capital markets, locked-in revenue streams, or defense exposure are executing, while the thinly capitalized names are either restructuring their debt or shutting down entirely.
For investors, the signal is that this isn't a momentum trade anymore. The sector is bifurcating on fundamentals: balance sheet strength, fuel hedging, and revenue diversification are what's being rewarded. And this week's filings gave us three very clear examples of exactly that.
The most important signal this week came from the credit and capital markets side of aviation, specifically the wave of balance sheet actions by companies that are positioning for a prolonged high fuel environment.
Allegiant's debt refinancing, Frontier's credit card facility expansion, and the Honeywell Aerospace separation all point to the same thing. Management teams across the sector are actively restructuring their capital positions right now, not waiting.
Operationally, what that means is the companies that can access capital are extending their runways and locking in terms before conditions potentially tighten further. The ones that can't are the ones we're watching file for administration across Europe and Asia.
For investors, the implication is that the survivor group is starting to define itself through action, not just relative stock performance. When you see debt refinancings, facility expansions, and structural separations all in the same week, that's a cluster of signals worth paying attention to.
And that cluster is the spine of what we're covering today.
All right, let's get into the price action, because this was not a quiet week. Defense was the story. Kratos up nearly 18%, Northrop up close to 11%, Lockheed up almost 9%. That's not a single stock move. That's a sector rotation.
The common pressure behind this coordinated move was defense spending expectations in the context of an active conflict. When the Strait of Hormuz situation escalates to the point where U.S. forces are launching strikes on Iranian targets, the defense budget outlook changes, and the market moved all the primes and several of the smaller contractors in lockstep.
General Dynamics up over 7, Raytheon up more than 6. Even Boeing was up 5.5, which isn't purely defense, but benefits from the same budget conversation.
What matters here isn't the individual percentage moves. It's that the defense subsector repriced as a group, which tells you this is macro positioning, not individual company news.
Now let's flip to the airlines, because it was a different story entirely. Southwest down nearly 3%, Alaska down almost 2%, United down close to 1.5%. Delta essentially flat, fractionally negative.
And that divergence against the defense move is actually the week's most important structural read. The airlines are caught between two forces: TSA data that's still holding up and fuel costs that are eating the margin.
Speaking of TSA, Sarah, give us the number.
This week, TSA screened 16.2 million passengers, which is down 1.1% year over year and 0.4% above the 3-year average. So demand is still there. This isn't a demand problem.
Right, the consumer is still flying. But at $105 a barrel for Brent crude and jet fuel running at nearly $2.70 a gallon at the Gulf Coast, that's before crisis era premiums. The airlines are fighting a cost war, not a demand war.
And that's why you see the divergence. Defense names benefit from the same geopolitical event that's crushing airline margins. It's the same crisis, two completely different earnings trajectories.
On the cargo side, FedEx down nearly 4%, UPS up about 2.5%. That split is interesting. FedEx just completed its freight spinoff and the stock pulled back, which is partly post-event selling.
The FedEx move has a mechanical explanation. The freight spinoff closed at the start of June, and director option exercises this week from the Form 4 filing were part of the plan adjustment tied to that separation. Market may be working through the post-spinoff re-rating.
UPS being up while FedEx sold off suggests the market sees UPS's integrated model differently right now. Cargo pricing power matters in a high fuel environment. The question is, who can pass those costs through?
What matters is that this isn't a cargo demand story. It's a cost absorption story. The carriers that have pricing leverage or fuel hedges are the ones holding value.
On the MRO and component side, HAECO up 3.3%, VSE Corporation up 3.5%. The aftermarket is quietly doing well here.
That makes sense in this environment. When new deliveries are constrained and fuel costs are high, airlines sweat their existing assets harder, which flows directly to the MRO and parts suppliers. HAECO and VSE are beneficiaries of that dynamic.
And on the eVTOL names, Archer up about 6.5%, Joby fractionally down. We'll get into the Joby filing in detail, but those two moved differently this week, despite being in the same category.
The divergence between Archer and Joby is worth noting, and we'll come back to it. But the headline from the week is clear: defense up sharply, airlines down modestly, aftermarket holding firm, and cargo mixed.
And the through line connecting all of it is the fuel shock. This is what a prolonged commodity disruption looks like when it runs through an industry with thin margins and long asset lives. Some names are built for it, most aren't.
So let's dig into the capital markets activity, because when you line up the Allegiant refinancing, the Frontier credit card deal, and the Honeywell separation in the same week, you're not looking at coincidence. You're looking at a coordinated sector response to a specific threat environment.
Walk me through the Allegiant transaction first, because the mechanics here are actually pretty interesting.
So Allegiant issued $650 million in senior secured notes at 7.125%, maturing July 2031. They used $377.5 million of that to retire existing notes that were coming due in 2027 at 7.25%.
So they're paying down near-term debt with longer-dated paper. The rate is actually slightly lower on the new notes, 7.125 versus 7.25. But the real value isn't in the basis points. It's in the maturity extension.
That's exactly right. They pushed the wall out 4 years. In a high fuel environment where cash generation is uncertain quarter to quarter, having a 2027 maturity sitting on your balance sheet is a liability. Having a 2031 maturity is breathing room.
But here's where I want to push back slightly. The new notes are secured by first priority liens on substantially all company and guarantor assets, excluding aircraft, engines, and real property. That's a significant collateral package.
It is. And that tells you something about the market's price for that capital. 7.125 on secured paper with that collateral package is not cheap. This isn't a low-cost refinancing. This is a company paying up for runway.
Which is the right trade when the alternative is a maturity cliff in an uncertain fuel environment. But investors should notice that the asset exclusions matter. Aircraft and engines aren't in the collateral pool, which presumably reflects their financing structures separately.
Now layer in the Frontier transaction, because it reinforces the same thesis from a completely different angle. Frontier extended its Barclays credit card affinity agreement 8 years out to June 2037 and expanded the pre-purchased miles facility from $200 million to $375 million. That's an 87.5% increase.
That facility expansion is the part I keep coming back to. Pre-purchased miles are essentially a cash advance from Barclays against future loyalty revenue. Frontier just unlocked an additional $175 million in available liquidity without touching the debt markets.
And they locked it in through 2037, When you're a sub-investment grade carrier trying to navigate a fuel shock, having that kind of off-balance sheet liquidity backstop is meaningful. The timing, signed June 24th, filed June 30th, suggests this was a priority transaction for the quarter.
Here's my question on Frontier, though. The stock was up just about 1% on the week, essentially flat. If this is a material liquidity improvement, why didn't the market respond more strongly?
Because Frontier's structural challenges go beyond near-term liquidity. The ultra-low-cost model is under maximum pressure in a high-fuel environment. You can solve for cash availability, but if your unit economics are broken at current fuel prices, the facility expansion buys time, not salvation.
That's a fair distinction. Allegiant's guidance flip to $1.25 EPS, up from a projected 50-cent loss, suggests their combined entity with Sun Country is generating real cash. Frontier's liquidity move is more defensive.
And that's the bifurcation within the low-cost carrier space that I think investors need to internalize. Allegiant's Q2 guidance revision was driven by two things: favorable demand across both carriers through quarter end, and fuel cost reductions from the Sun Country acquisition synergies. That's an operating improvement, not just a financial engineering story.
The Sun Country acquisition closed May 13th. They're already seeing the combined entity benefits in the Q2 numbers. That's a faster integration timeline than most acquisitions in this industry.
Which is probably why the Allegiant stock is up almost 4% on the week, while Frontier is essentially flat. The market is reading those two as fundamentally different risk profiles right now, even though they both did capital markets transactions in the same week.
And then the Honeywell separation adds a third data point to this capital markets theme, though from a completely different category.
The separation is interesting because it's not a response to stress. It's a proactive structural move that's been in planning for a long time. Honeywell Aerospace started trading on NASDAQ under ticker HONA on June 29th at a 1-for-2 distribution ratio.
One share of HONA for every 2 shares of HON held on the June 15th record date. The CFO's Form 4, filed July 1st, shows the equity adjustment mechanics. PSU vesting events triggered by the spin-off completion, adjusted employee stock options, the whole compensation realignment.
What I find significant here is that the parent, HON stock, was up about 90 basis points on the week despite shedding a major business unit. The market isn't punishing Honeywell for this separation. It's rewarding the clarity.
That's the conglomerate discount argument playing out in real time. When you have an avionics and systems business bundled with industrial automation and building technologies, analysts struggle to value any of it cleanly. The separation lets each entity trade on its own merits.
For HONA specifically, the pure-play aerospace avionics story has a very different investor base than the diversified Honeywell. Defense electronics, cockpit systems, satellite communications, those are businesses that attract defense sector multiples, not industrial multiples.
And in a week where defense is up 8 to 18%, launching as a pure-play aerospace and defense-adjacent avionics company is genuinely good timing.
Whether that timing was intentional or just fortunate, the net result is that Honeywell Aerospace enters the market in a favorable sector environment.
All right, let me shift gears to the second supporting signal this week, because the eVTOL space had two materially different filings that I don't think should be read as equivalent, even though Archer and Joby are usually lumped together.
The Joby Toyota manufacturing joint venture is the more consequential filing. Joby and Toyota created a new entity, Joby Toyota Aero Manufacturing Preparation Company, which they're calling JTAMP-C, with a 49-51 ownership split. Joby contributing $980,000 for its stake, Toyota contributing just over $1 million for 51%, and 3 of 5 board seats.
The capital amounts here are almost symbolic. Less than $2 million total to establish the entity. This isn't the transaction itself. This is the legal infrastructure for a much larger manufacturing commitment.
That's the right way to read it. Toyota doesn't establish joint ventures with three board seats and majority control for $2 million unless the roadmap behind it involves significant capital deployment. This is the governance structure being stood up before the real investment flows.
And Toyota's manufacturing expertise is exactly what Joby needs. Building aircraft at scale is a fundamentally different challenge than certifying a single prototype. Toyota's production system, Kaizen, just-in-time, quality control at volume, that's intellectual capital that money can't easily replicate.
The question I keep asking is what Toyota gets out of this. And I think the answer is a beachhead in the urban air mobility supply chain before the market matures. If eVTOL becomes a mainstream transportation category in the 2030s, Toyota wants to be inside the manufacturing ecosystem, not buying into it at a premium later.
Strategic optionality at relatively low entry cost. That's a very Toyota-like move, actually.
Now contrast that with Archer. The annual meeting outcome was interesting, not because of the director votes, which were routine, but because the Texas redomestication failed. 234 million votes in favor, 44.5 million against, and it fell short of the requisite threshold.
That's a meaningful shareholder rejection. Redomestications to Texas have become a trend among certain tech-adjacent companies, and the arguments usually center on reduced litigation exposure and a more business-friendly legal environment. Archer's shareholders weren't persuaded.
Delaware incorporation carries real value in terms of established case law and investor protections. When 44.5 million shares vote against a management-supported proposal, that's shareholders sending a message that they're not willing to trade away those protections.
And it creates an interesting governance dynamic. Management wanted the redomestication, presumably for cost or flexibility reasons, and the shareholders blocked it. That tension doesn't disappear after one failed vote.
The Archer stock was up 6.5% on the week despite the failed vote, so the market isn't reading the rejection as catastrophic. But it does tell you something about the investor composition. They're not just momentum buyers. They have views on governance structure.
Which actually makes sense given where Archer is in its development cycle. If you're a long-duration investor in a pre-revenue eVTOL company, Delaware's legal framework is a real consideration. You want robust shareholder protections when the company is years from commercialization.
The contrast between the two eVTOL filings this week is instructive. Joby is building manufacturing infrastructure through a strategic partnership with one of the world's premier manufacturers. Archer is navigating a governance dispute with its own shareholders. Those are very different execution stories.
And Joby's stock being fractionally down while Archer was up 6% suggests the market hasn't fully priced the manufacturing partnership yet, or is discounting it because the capital amounts are so small at this stage.
Which might actually be the opportunity. The real significance of the J. Tampasi filing isn't the $2 million. It's that Toyota is now legally committed to a governance structure that positions them for much larger participation as the program matures.
When you're evaluating eVTOL names, the question isn't who has the better aircraft on paper. It's who has the manufacturing and capital partnerships to survive the valley between certification and commercial scale. This week, Joby made a move that addresses exactly that question.
So, let's talk about the divergence that's been sitting underneath everything we've covered today, because I think it's the most important read for anyone trying to position around this sector right now. Defense up 8 to 18% in a single week. Major airlines down 1 to 3%. Aftermarket holding, eVTOL mixed. Is this cyclical positioning or structural differentiation?
I come down firmly on structural. When Kratos is up nearly 18% and Southwest is down almost 3% in the same week, driven by the same geopolitical event, that's not rotation. That's the market repricing two completely different business models in response to the same input.
The fuel price is the variable that makes this structural. A cyclical read would say, when the Strait of Hormuz stabilizes, fuel comes down, airlines recover, defense gives back some of its gains, and we return to prior relationships. But I'm not sure that's the right framework here.
Here's why I push back on the cyclical read. the defense budget conversation has structurally shifted. When U.S. forces are launching strikes on Iranian targets and the Strait of Hormuz is disrupted, Congress's appetite for defense spending doesn't just temporarily increase, it recalibrates. The primes are pricing in a multi-year spending environment, not a quarter.
And on the airline side, the fleet constraints that were already pressuring capacity, the Boeing delivery delays, the engine inspection requirements, those don't resolve when geopolitical tensions ease. So the airlines are facing a cost shock on top of structural capacity constraints that predate this crisis.
That's the crux of it. The crisis is amplifying pre-existing structural conditions on both sides. Defense was already in a favorable budget cycle before the Hormuz escalation. Airlines were already dealing with constrained capacity and thin margins before fuel spiked.
Which means when the crisis eventually de-escalates, and it will, we shouldn't expect the sector relationships to snap back to where they were in January. The underlying structures have shifted.
The insider activity this week actually supports that RID. Shane Tackett at Alaska Air directly acquiring 43,555 shares on June 29th. That's a meaningful personal commitment at a moment when the stock is under pressure. That's a CFO telling you he thinks the current price doesn't reflect long-term value.
And on the defense side, the Kratos insider sales, Fendley selling 7,000 shares at $48 and change, Rock selling 4,600 shares at $50, those were pre-planned 10b5-1 transactions. They don't signal that insiders think the rally is over. They signal that insiders had planned exits that happened to execute into a strong week.
Right. You have to separate mechanical 10b5-1 sells from discretionary activity. The Alaska Air purchase is discretionary. The Kratos sells are pre-planned. Those are completely different signals.
So the base case is that defense outperformance versus commercial aviation is structural and durable through at least year end. But the key risk is a rapid Hormuz resolution that simultaneously compresses defense multiples and relieves fuel pressure on airlines, collapsing the spread faster than the market currently expects.
That's the trade to watch. And now let me tell you exactly what I'll be monitoring in the week ahead to see whether that base case is holding.
Give me your four watch items.
Watch Hona's first full week of trading volume and where the pure play aerospace stock finds its price discovery level, because it will confirm or contradict whether the conglomerate discount thesis that drove the HON spinoff is actually being rewarded by the market.
That's the one I'm most focused on. If Hona trades at a premium to the implied separation value, it validates the entire pure-play aerospace thesis and puts pressure on other diversified industrials with aviation exposure to consider similar separations.
Watch any Q2 pre-announcement activity from the major legacy carriers, particularly United and Delta, because it will confirm or contradict whether the fuel cost headwinds we're reading in the macro data are already showing up in real operating results ahead of earnings season.
United was down close to 1.5% this week with no specific negative catalyst. If they guide down before earnings, that move looks like early information leakage. If they stay quiet, the stock has room to recover.
Watch Allegiant's Q3 capacity and fuel hedging disclosures whenever they surface, because it will confirm or contradict whether the Sun Country integration synergies are durable into the back half of the year, or were a one-quarter benefit from the timing of the acquisition close.
The Q2 guidance flip to $1.25 was dramatic enough that the market needs to see follow-through. One quarter of outperformance after an acquisition isn't a thesis. It's a data point. Q3 is where the integration story gets tested.
And watch. Any congressional testimony or DoD contract announcements touching Kratos, Northrop, or Lockheed, because it will confirm or contradict whether the defense rally this week was pricing in real contract flows or just sentiment around elevated spending expectations.
Kratos up nearly 18% in a week is extraordinary. If there's no contract announcement or program win behind it in the next 2 to 3 weeks, some of that move is at risk of giving back. The market needs a fundamental anchor for a move that size.
Those four items are your scorecard for whether the structural divergence thesis holds or whether this was a one-week overshoot in both directions.
So let me bring this together, because we covered a lot of ground and I want to leave listeners with a clear frame.
Go ahead.
This week's story was fundamentally about capital access, geopolitical repricing, and the early innings of a sector bifurcation that we think has more runway. The companies with balance sheet flexibility, defense exposure, or durable revenue streams are separating from the ones without. The Strait of Hormuz crisis is the accelerant making that separation visible faster than it would have happened otherwise. And the filings this week, Allegiant's refinancing, Frontier's facility expansion, Honeywell's separation, and Joby's Toyota manufacturing partnership, all point to management teams who are actively building for a world where the current operating environment is the baseline, not the exception.
That's the frame. And what I'd add is that the TSA number, 16.2 million passengers, down 1.1% year over year, but still above the 3-year average, tells you the demand is intact. This sector's challenge right now is not on the revenue side. It's entirely on the cost and capital side.
Which means the companies solving for cost structure and capital durability right now are the ones you want to own when the environment eventually normalizes. The ones waiting are falling further behind with every week this continues.
That's the week. Thank you for listening to Aviation Intelligence Weekly. We'll be back next week with earnings season beginning to ramp and more filings to unpack.
As always, stay disciplined, stay data-driven, and we'll see you in the air.
This podcast is produced for informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice, a solicitation, or a recommendation to buy or sell any security. All data referenced, including SEC filings, stock performance figures, TSA checkpoint statistics, and macroeconomic context, reflects information available as of the publication date and may be subject to revision. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own due diligence and consult a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions. Aviation Intelligence Weekly and its hosts may hold positions in securities discussed on this program.
Welcome to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Want the inside track on aviation's biggest players? Aviation Intelligence Weekly brings you expert analysis of airline earnings, breaking industry news, and deep dive company histories. From American Airlines to Boeing, we cover the business of flight every week. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.